Case number 07-1455 et al. Tribune Publishing Company, Petitioner versus National Labor Relations Board. Mr. Zinser for the petitioner, Mr. Lauro for the respondent.
Judge Santel, Judge Griffith, Judge Randolph, good morning. May it please the court, I'm Michael Zinser, and I'm here this morning to represent the Columbia Daily Tribune. Our position in this case is fairly simple. This case involves money deducted from the wages of employees in payment of membership dues to a union in the context of an expired collective bargaining agreement. Now, in order for a union to require such payment of monies from employees' wages. That right is rooted in Section 302C4 of the National Labor Relations Act, and a union's right to require that money requires that there be a provision codified in an existing collective bargaining agreement.
Yeah, well, 302 doesn't say that. Where does it say that in 302? It doesn't.
Well, that's the, Your Honor, that's the long established interpretation of that section in the context of provisions remitting.
There's a dicta in the Supreme Court, and then, and I know there's a statement in one of our cases, but if you read the statute, it doesn't say any such thing. It just says that these provisions are not applicable with respect to money deducted from the wages of an employee in payment of membership dues. It doesn't say anything about collective bargaining agreement there. On condition that each employee has made a written assignment, still nothing about collective bargaining, which shall not be irrevocable for a period of more than 1 year, right, or beyond the termination of the applicable collective bargaining agreement. So if on the face of it, if the employees execute written assignments, then this provision, and it's less than 1 year, and here it was revocable at will, right?
That's correct.
Right. So there's no requirement on the face of this for a collective bargaining agreement.
But in for decades, in terms of case law and in terms of National Labor Relations Board case law,
maybe they're wrong. And the Supreme Court case is dicta.
Well, Your Honor, we're here this morning to try to persuade you that that precedent and that long-established principle should be followed.
It doesn't matter here because there is a collective bargaining agreement.
Because what, Your Honor, I didn't hear you.
Because there was a collective bargaining agreement.
Well, no, the collective bargaining agreement expired on November
1st. No, you entered into another one with respect to dues. The union and the company entered into an agreement after the formal collective bargaining agreement expired to deduct dues. That's a collective bargaining agreement.
You acted on it 1 month.
Right. It's collective. It's an agreement. Everybody acknowledges that. It's a collective bargaining agreement because the union was acting on behalf of employees and it entered into that agreement with the company. The only difference is it didn't cover a lot of subjects and it wasn't in writing. But under the National Labor Relations Act, it doesn't have to be in writing unless one of the parties requests it, and neither party requested it be in writing. So that's a collective bargaining agreement.
Your Honor, it was...
Do you have any authority to the contrary?
Well, let me just say this. In every case that has considered this issue of an employer's right to discontinue deducting money from employees' wages, there has always been a written collective bargaining agreement.
Has there ever been one that considered a case in which there had been a further oral agreement between the management and the union for the checkoff of dues, for the collection of dues?
I'm unaware of one, Your Honor.
Right. So you don't have a precedent on point, do you? You have precedents that go as far as you were before the company made the second agreement, the oral agreement. But there's no case that's parallel to this one on the point that Judge Randolph raises, is there?
To the best of my knowledge, that is correct, Your Honor. But the Columbia Daily Tribune does not consider this to be a collective bargaining agreement. Rather, this was a one-time occurrence. The National Labor Relations Board's decision said it became a term and condition of employment. Where's the quid pro quo? How long does the agreement last? It's not even a term.
It is a term. It's a mandatory term. The NLRB said that payroll deductions are a mandatory term of bargaining, and this is a payroll deduction. So it's clearly a term. You don't disagree with that, do you?
What I meant by that was there was not a beginning date and an ending date to this new agreement that we're talking about.
There's no labor law that says there has to be an ending date to it. You can have collective bargaining agreements in perpetuity. There's no rule that says there has to be a beginning and ending date.
Well, an agreement of indefinite duration is terminable at the will of either party. I'm back to the...
Not without bargaining, and that's the point. It's a mandatory subject of bargaining before you change the conditions, and that's the ruling of the NLRB.
And we assert this morning to the court that the NLRB was wrong, that the one-time use of the direct deposit system was the same thing as the provision that was in the expired collective bargaining agreement. The employer had the right under established case law to discontinue that. This is the functional equivalent. The employer had the right to discontinue it again because the facts at the time all of this occurred, these two parties, the company and the union, were in collective bargaining. They were in the process of negotiating a new agreement. They had not reached a new agreement. There was not in effect a collective bargaining agreement. In fact, the facts in this case show that the union was proposing to continue in a new agreement the same dues deduction language that had been in the expired agreement. They've proposed nothing about direct deposit. What really happened here was the union did an end run around and tried to circumvent the employer's right to discontinue, but the union's right to require the payment of this money, again, we assert, requires that it be codified in an existing collective bargaining agreement. One did not exist. And if a union can require an employer to send money under these circumstances, then the narrow exception of 302C4 has been eviscerated. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Do we need to hear him? We'll hear from the government.
Good morning, Your Honors. Greg Lauro for the National Labor Relations Board, seeking full enforcement of the board's order. As Your Honors just touched on, the essentially undisputed facts and legal principles support the board's finding. The parties agree that they reached this new agreement to use direct deposit months after the collective bargaining agreement expires. They concede it touched on a mandatory subject of bargaining, which means the employer is not privileged to unilaterally terminate the agreement, and they concede the employer did just that here. It terminated the agreement without bargaining. Their only direct challenge to the agreement formation finding is that they were tricked or the union was trying to do an end around the law, but they provide no evidence whatsoever for that finding. Indeed, their own witness agrees that they reached this agreement and thought it was a good idea at the time. As also discussed this morning, the remainder of the company's arguments turn on the view that they don't have to comply with the terms of an expired agreement. The problem is that's not the issue before the court today. As the board noted, the issue is not a duty to comply with an expired CBA, but a duty to comply with the new agreement you had reached, which had not terminated by its own terms. And every other argument they make reiterates the same false premise. We didn't have to comply with the expired CBA.
What's the definition of a collective bargaining agreement? Does the board have one? The Act doesn't define it.
Well, I mean, in this case, as Your Honors noted, there was clearly an agreement on this term. Whether you want to call it a full collective bargaining agreement or not,
Are there cases in which, during the course of negotiation between labor and management, before reaching a final collective bargaining agreement covering all the major terms, that things are implemented, for example, the wage and hour rules or the vacation or benefits, and they go along, and it may take months to hammer all this stuff out. Are they considered collective bargaining agreements when the interim agreements are reached and implemented?
Your Honor, I think the point is, regardless of the terminology, this is an agreement on a mandatory subject of bargaining, which cannot be unilaterally terminated.
Well, we have this one case that frankly, I don't think really parses the language of the 302, but it says, well, you have to have a collective bargaining agreement. It says it in the opinion. So you say, well, the terminology doesn't matter, but maybe it does because of our decision.
Well, two things, Your Honor. First, when I say the terminology doesn't matter, I mean one of the most settled principles in labor law is that under Section 8A5, you cannot unilaterally terminate an existing agreement on a mandatory subject of bargaining. As to other cases discussing 302, as Your Honors noted this morning, that discussion is dicta. My opponent is citing cases which addressed a different issue, which is, do you have to comply with the terms of the expired collective bargaining agreement? Now, in Southwest Steel, for example, it wasn't even a dues checkoff case. It addressed whether a hiring hall provision survived the expiration of the collective bargaining agreement. It cited Section 302 to cite the board's holding in Bethlehem Steel, which held a dues checkoff provision does not survive expiration of the CBA, at least where it's implementing a union security clause, which is not the situation here.
You're right, and we stressed it, that your opposing counsel doesn't have a case on point, but I'm not sure you do either. Is there a case concerning the management's failure to bargain before changing a condition of employment on a mandatory bargaining subject that involves only this sort of informal agreement during a time of the lapse of the CBA?
Well, Your Honor, I know of no case, and my opponent didn't raise any making an exception.
You didn't either. That's what I'm trying to establish. You're saying it's a well-established principle of labor law that you can't depart from an agreement concerning a mandatory subject of bargaining without bargaining. I'm asking you if you have a case that applies that principle to something that is not a CBA in the formal sense, but is simply some sort of informal agreement reached during the time of lapse after the end of a CBA.
We do not have such a case, Your Honor.
It's really not that well established with regard to these facts, is it, Counsel?
Well, Your Honor, I think actually it is quite well established. When you go
can't give me a single case on it, but it's well established?
There's a statute, Your Honor. When you look at Section 8A5 and Section 8D, it's a duty to bargain over certain terms of conditions of employment, which has been interpreted to mean mandatory subjects.
Yeah.
The rule is that you have to bargain before changing terms that involve a mandatory subject of bargaining. There is no discussion there of a requirement of an existing collective bargaining agreement or that the negotiation has to turn on a collective bargaining agreement. It's just about the duty to bargain. When you're talking about a mandatory subject of bargaining, as we admittedly are here, you cannot unilaterally terminate the party's agreement. That's what we're relying on, sir. And we also point out in our brief, as you know,
we have a subject matter here that does not survive the termination of a CBA.
That's correct.
There's no question about what they could stop the check of the checkoff, the collection of dues at the end of the CBA.
Yes, they could.
If there had not been this informal agreement, whatever we wish to call it, they could have kept on not deducting dues. They didn't have to deduct dues.
That's right. They didn't have to. They chose to by express agreement with the union, and that's the key finding here, which is unchallenged.
But doesn't 302C4 tell us that they can only do that if there is a collective bargaining agreement that's enforced? And the terms of the statute are the applicable collective agreement. And so is it your contention that the agreement that was struck between the employee at the company and the union was in fact this type of agreement? It's an applicable collective agreement under 302C4?
Your Honor, to fully answer your question about 302C4, I have to make a couple points. First, as you know, it's our position the company failed to even raise Section 302 as an argument. Second, it's our position that that separate statute, Section 8A5 determines the duty to bargain. The separate statute in Section 302 doesn't help the company because nothing in that statute permits the employer to do what it did here, unilaterally terminate an existing agreement on a mandatory subject of bargaining. Now, as was also mentioned this morning, the language you cite in the reference to a collective bargaining agreement merely says that the employees must give their written authorization and it must be revocable either after 1 year or at the termination of the collective bargaining agreement, whichever occurs sooner. It refers.
We don't have that problem here because these things were irrevocable at will, right?
Absolutely, and the parties agree to that.
That clause is irrelevant to this case.
The irrevocability
clause is irrelevant to this case.
That's correct because the parties agree it was satisfied by the written authorizations here, right. Your Honor.
And that's the only mention of collective bargaining agreement 302.
I believe that's correct.
On irrevocability.
I believe that's correct. So in sum, it's the board's view that its findings are supported by the undisputed facts and principles, that you have a new agreement on a mandatory subject of bargaining, and under the most established law, you cannot unilaterally terminate that. So unless Your Honors have further questions, I thank the court for its time.
Thank you, counsel. How much time do you have left?
2 minutes remaining.
2 minutes remaining. We'll hear you in rebuttal, counsel.
Thank you.
I will just close by saying to the court that taking money out of employees' paychecks to pay union dues, it has a special place in the law, and I think the overall statutory intention of Section 302 was to protect the rights of employees and make it very difficult for employers to funnel money to labor unions to prevent all sorts of things.
You can't do it without the union's agreement. Right. True.
There must be a collective bargaining agreement, and the collective bargaining agreement must contain a negotiated clause where the company and the union have agreed to this. Then the third piece of that, of course, is the authorization.
What's the language that says there has to be a CBA?
I'm relying upon, you know, the many decades of cases that say there has to be an
exception. 302 does not by its terms require that there be a CBA, does it?
But I think when you read the statute in its entirety, I mean, I think the implication and the assumption is there's going to be a written collective bargaining agreement.
The authorization from the employees will cease with the CBA or the end of a year, whichever is first, which says what happens if there's a CBA. It doesn't necessarily say there has to be one. What the statute says there has to be is the authorization from the employee.
All right. Well, I think from a policy point of view, the thing to do to protect the rights of employees is for you to rule that there must be a written document and a
In
clear
the real
agreement.
World, I've heard them imagining it happening without a CBA. I understand what you're saying.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted. Call the next case.